Our next speaker hardly needs an introduction. He said, call me whatever you want. And I said, well, better not get that carried away. Jeff Welton's going to talk about grounding towers, and that's something, and lightning protection. It's something we all have to deal with and have dealt with through the years, and I'm sure all of us have several war stories about taking hits of lightning and what kind of damage it can do. So, Jeff, this is your second talk, and last night the nuts and bolts session, he offered a lot, so I didn't lose your resume, I had it, and somebody took it, the cleanup crew took it, so I can't read all the great things he's done, and all the degrees, and you're laughing, so we better get going this morning, so here it is, I'm going to turn over to Jeff.
He'd make me all bashful, but I got over being shy a while ago. I'm going to pretend to be all nervous because my boss is in the back. You've all met Chuck, I think, at least once or twice. I told him, I said, it's his fault. So if I stumble on anything, we're going to blame Chuck just because he's there. They brought me in to ask me if I could write something on lightning protection. As most of you may know, some of you may not, we have quite a few papers over the years on lightning protection. It's something we started out building beacon transmitters in the late 60s, early 70s. And beacon transmitters typically go on the shore with a short tower or at the end of the airport. They're kind of critical, you know, especially back then. They tended to get a little upset if they didn't hear that Morse code ident when they were trying to find the runway. So lightning protection is something we've spent a lot of years studying. As we moved into broadcast with taller towers and moved into the offshore industry where, golly gee, a 100-foot tower on an oil rig in the middle of the ocean can be the tallest thing for a whole bunch of miles around, we've really sharpened our focus on it, and we've had a whole lot of fun in the process. We've learned a few things, and hopefully I can pass some of that along. Obviously, from a broadcast perspective, that can be one of the scariest and most awe-inspiring sights you can ever see. It's awe-inspiring because you have a pretty good grasp of how much electricity is in that little ray of light. It's terrifying because you realize that it tends to hit the tallest thing around, and connected to the end of that tallest thing around is several hundred thousand dollars worth of transmission and STL equipment. Some of the things we want to look at are lightning, its function, and the characteristics, because if you understand how a lightning bolt works, you got a better way of sort of figuring out what you got to do to, you can't stop it, but maybe you can at least exert some control over where it goes. And electromagnetic susceptibility, because it's not just the lightning bolt that can cause the damage. A lightning bolt will ionize a lot of air around it, and that ionized air can cause some pretty unique and interesting discharges on its own. If anybody's ever seen ball lightning rolling out the front door of the transmitter building, you get an idea where I'm going from. So the things we got to look at, you got to look at the site as a whole, and you can also break it down into the antenna system and the transmitter building. Our former chief engineer, one of the founders of our company, literally wrote the book on lightning protection, at least as it's presented on our website. And one of the things John Pinks told me one day, he said, when you're looking at lightning protection, the easiest way is to pretend you're lightning. Start at the tower, and remember, all you want to do is find ground. Follow the conductive paths back to the transmitter building, looking for ground everywhere you can. And remember, you're not afraid to jump if you have to. And once you start looking at it from that perspective, it gets a little easier to figure out the currents and the paths that it's going to take. There's a couple of things you need to know about a lightning strike. Number one, it's got a very fast rise time, typically in the 0.2 to 0.5 millisecond range, with a decay time of 2 to 5 microseconds. What that means, if you convert those times into wavelengths, is that your rise time falls almost into the FM band, your decay time falls almost into the AM band. There's a ringing on the top that falls into your STL band. So what we're saying here is there's components of every frequency that you're trying to pass by design in this lightning strike. It can have a pulse width of several hundred microseconds. It can have a peak amplitude 20,000 amps. Well, 20,000 amps, if you got half an ohm of resistance, there's a fair amount of power coming down the line. Remember that you got about a 5% probability that that strike is going to exceed 100,000 amps. At that point, it probably doesn't matter how well you've got it grounded, because a 4-inch strap, when you run 100,000 amps through it, is going to become a really effective fuse. Ultimately, as I said, we can't stop them all, we can't defer them all. One of the things you need to realize, and one of the things I've seen, and everybody, as Cliff said, or as Gary said rather, has got a horror story about lightning. One of the things that we've seen, I'll give you an example. I had a 2.5 kilowatt in Trenton, New Jersey. It got hit by lightning so hard it blew the ball gaps off the tower. Okay, they found one of the balls 50 yards away from the tower. Okay, the telephone was buried in the concrete wall on the other side of the transmitter room. An hour after the station went off air, when we got to the site, there was smoke coming out of the processor and the remote control still. Transmitter, of course, is sitting there showing a whole bunch of red lights with nothing coming out of it. All right, the ATU literally looked like somebody had tossed a grenade in there. It was fragments inside. Fragments, there were even bulges in the ATU cabinet. Okay, it had exploded. We found one blown 85-cent IC in the transmitter. We slapped a CD player on it, staped 300 feet of clothesline, basically, around the perimeter of the transmitter building outside for a makeshift antenna, had the thing on air at quarter power half an hour later. Okay, that's the difference between good grounding and bad grounding, where the transmitter probably still wouldn't be running 5 years later. All right. You can move a lot of energy in a lightning strike, several hundred coulombs of energy. MOVs, if you've got them, have a finite life. They will transfer so much energy, X number of coulombs. After so many strikes, they're going to fail. MOVs always fail short circuit. Now, if the current's still flowing, then they explode, and then now, of course, it's an open circuit. But typical failure mode will always be a short circuit. So if you've got MOV-based protection, whether it's an outboard surge box, whether it's MOVs on a transformer, make sure you've got spares of those. Eventually, they'll fail if they're doing their job. If they don't fail, they're not doing anything anyway. Okay? Remember, you need to fuse them. I've run into situations where all of our surge boxes in-house and all the polyphasers and LEAs I've worked with, all the shunt-type boxes have series fuses. Well, you know what? A 30-amp stove fuse, when it's replaced with a 3/8-inch bolt, is probably going to be an issue when that MOV shorts. All right? So keep spares of the fuses as well, for the same reason. Once that fuse blows, that MOV is not going to do you a lot of good. Okay, so your half amplitude on lightning corresponds to about 25 kilohertz, top end of the audio band. Okay, if you're running an FM system, it's well within your FM baseband. Rise time, 0.2 microseconds, as I said, which if you do the math backwards corresponds to 500 kilohertz. Am I doing that right? I'm trying to do math in my head, and it's really early, so correct me if I'm wrong. Okay, whoops, get back there. All right, if you look at the crest current, in kiloamps, oh, I did it again. Come on, there we go. Crest current in kiloamps versus the percent chance of getting nailed. You can see that obviously your percent chance of getting a very high strike is pretty low, and a very low strike is pretty high. As I said, the median is typically in the 20,000 amp range. How much you spend is going to vary a lot. If you're in Paraguay, where the average lightning incidence is about 150 to 200 strikes per square kilometer per year, and you've got a 600-foot tower in a flat area, which means you're going to get all the strikes for your square kilometer plus theirs, plus theirs, plus theirs, you're probably going to spend a little more than if you're in say, I don't know, Montana, where strike incidence is a couple of strikes per square kilometer per year. Okay, it depends on how much you're trying to protect. If you're running a 1 kilowatt with a total equipment investment in the site of $50,000, you're not going to spend $200,000 to protect it. If you got $500,000 worth of TV equipment, maybe you are. Okay? Loss of revenue. Again, what's it worth to be off the air? And the probability, as I said. Visala, incidentally, works with NOAA, and this is the Forbel Global Atmospherics. These are one of the better companies for getting lightning strike data. And as you can see in the U.S., as you go to the southeast, your chances of getting nailed go up pretty exponentially. I'm guaranteeing a 1,000-foot tower in Florida will see a lot more activity than a 200 or 2,000-foot tower in North Dakota, as a rule. Okay, so most sites look something like this. Now, this paper, for what it's worth, is written around AM, but it does apply to TV, to FM, to cellular, anything with an antenna, and with a power line, and with a transmitter in the middle. Incidentally, that is the whole wrong way to do it. Your antenna comes in here, your power goes out there, your transmitter's in the middle, and if you follow a lot of conventional routines, the transmitter's the path to ground. Probably not recommended. Okay, typically there'll be a ground strap. There's always the radials on an AM antenna. For an FM, you'll have a reference ground or a well, something like that. So what we want to do as we start at the tower being a lightning bolt and head back, we want to get to ground, number one, before we get to the transmitter at all. Number two, if we can't get to ground before we get to the transmitter, we don't want to go through it. We want to go around it. Well, I'm a lightning bolt, I don't care, but as an engineer, you kind of prefer that you don't go through the equipment you're trying to protect. Okay, so a couple of things we can do on an AM station. DC blocking. Remember, you got a slow decay time, very low frequency stuff. Put in a series capacitor that'll block that. As the air ionizes prior to a lightning strike, there's a huge DC component. Again, you can block that. Give me a static drain for a path to ground. A spark gap properly set. Now this is critical and we'll touch on it again later, but most spark gaps are not set properly. If I walk into a 50 ohm antenna, I'm arbitrarily picking a value, and I see a spark gap where the balls are that far apart, lightning likes to jump, but it doesn't like to jump far. All right? Do some inspections. If you've got a drain choke that looks like that, probably not going to dissipate a lot of the static buildup. Okay? Whoops, back up the bus. There we go. Do inspections. These are actual transmitter sites I've walked into over the years. I spent 16 and a half years doing field service, and then they slapped the sales shirt on me and said, go out and talk. And I said, cool. If you have a bird's nest in your ATU, it's probably not well enough protected from the weather. Just saying. Okay, that one incidentally was in what used to be an outhouse beside the transmitter building, which used to be the caretaker's house for the fairground it was on 40 years before when it was built. All right, ground rods. Ground rods are one of those unique things. You can have too many. All right, we were talking earlier out back, Gary and I were talking about galvanic corrosion, about how things can literally erode each other if they come in contact. It doesn't have to be physical contact. With ground rods, if you have them spaced closer than double their length apart, so if I've got a 10-foot ground rod and they're closer than 20 feet together, the electrode interference hemispheres will overlap and I've created a diode. Depending on the potential, one end will be the anode, one end will be the cathode, and one end will literally erode very quickly. Okay, a ground rod's not much good if it's just a 4-inch stub going into the ground with your strap connected to it. So make sure they're not too close together. We recommend that you CAD weld or silver solder all connections. because a mechanical connection will oxidize. And copper or copper-clad steel, just because of the charge transfer abilities. Copper-clad steel is easier to drive. Yes, Steve?
Welding cable or copper strap? Connect rod to the tower.
My preference is strap because of the high-frequency component on the lightning and the skim effect. The more surface area you can give that lightning to travel to ground or in the direction you want, the less resistance it will take following that path. Ultimately, what we're looking for is a low-impedance path to ground, and strap to a lightning strike is much lower impedance than even a 4-aught cable. For what it's worth, a 2-inch strap and a 4-aught cable have very close to the same surface area, except 2-inch strap is a whole pile cheaper. And it's flat. It doesn't tend to be trippy when you walk over it. Okay, talking about ball gaps, and I had this conversation with, is George here today? Yes, he is. Ball gaps are a wonderful thing, but if rain is dripping across them, then it's a quarter inch, a 16th of an inch, a quarter inch, a 16th of an inch. If you're trying to stop several hundred thousand volts, when it's a 16th of an inch, the lightning's going to take that jump, and it's going to arc. Most transmitters these days, when you arc a ball gap, transmitter go tick, tick. Go down and come back up again. Well, if you do that several hundred times an hour, it starts to get kind of annoying. So in addition to having them properly set, it's a good idea to have them enclosed as much as possible. If you can keep the rain off them and keep the bugs out of them, number one, you can set them tighter without having them arc every time it does get a little damp. And number two, they don't, we had 100 kilowatt in Ethiopia, and the thing was always shutting back, and after several hundred shutbacks, it occasionally blow a power module. I mean, you can only short something so long before it says, you know, I've had enough of this. And what we found out, I wish I had brought the picture. We went out, one of the guys flew to Ethiopia to do the inspection. I won't tell you his stories of the travel, but that's a whole nother topic someday. Anyway, he flies to the site. He's inspecting everything. The grounding is beautiful. They've got chem rods down. They can't get to the water table. It's pretty deep, but they've established a good chemical ground. Everything is just grounded perfectly, star grounding like we recommend. He's out there, he walks out to the tower, he looks at the ball gap, and it looks like a forest of little itty-bitty trees on it. Like just little things sticking out, sharp things sticking out, eighth of an inch, 3/8 of an inch, something like that. He comes back the next morning, and what he finds is there's a trail of ants going up, crawling up over the ball gap, and getting vaporized. Ant crawls up, transmitter arcs. Ant crawls up, transmitter arcs. Ants apparently are like lemmings. They'll just keep on going. He polished that off. We put in a totally enclosed ball gap system in NEMA boxes. Haven't had a problem since. That was several years ago. So it's the little things that can bite you sometimes. Okay? If you've got ball gaps, you can actually calculate what the spacing should be. We actually have a spreadsheet available where you can put in the diameter of the ball, you can put in your altitude, you can put in your SWR tolerance, you can put in several factors, and we'll come back and say, well, for this conditions, these balls should be this far apart. It's a good guideline. Keep in mind, if you're outdoors, because you have insects and weather, you're typically going to be further apart. If you can put them in an ATU input, you can space them closer together, something like that. Okay, we prefer not to have horn gaps or Jacob's ladders because they have sharp points which give you less of a uniform cross-sectional area and less prediction over at what voltage they will arc. Okay, balls are very uniform. Steel is less preferred, tungsten is more so, like we have on the base of most towers. What we use in most of our gear is polished carbon. It doesn't migrate when it arcs. After you migrate, and most people with an AM will have seen this, you look at the base of the tower at the ball gaps and there'll be pits in this one and mountains on this one. Because what happens is when it arcs, some of the metal goes from over there to over there. It makes the jump with the lightning. After you do that a bunch, you don't have a uniform surface anymore, and people are always rotating or polishing the balls. That's why. If you have carbon out there, polished carbon, that's not an issue. However, carbon has a downside. If you get that big lightning strike, they blow up real easy. They'll fragment into shards. It's really cool. I've met too many technical types that, in spite of the fact you spend your life trying to prevent it, it's still really fun to see stuff blow up, especially if you don't got to fix it. All right, again, indoor when you can, because that'll keep you away from... Has anybody ever had to deal with a snake wrapped around a ball gap or a contactor? It's ugly and it's not fun. I did a site in Louisiana. We were getting SWR shutback, SWR shutback over and over and over. And finally, we went out to inspect the ATUs. The third ATU in a four-tower array had half of a very angry diamondback wrapped around it. I looked at the engineer, said, I'm not paid enough to fix that. He looks at me, he says, don't think I'm touching it. And we went back in, we put the transmitter at 50,000 watts. I hit reset. Tick, 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 tick. Reset. Tick, 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 tick. Reset. 15 minutes later, it stopped shutting back, and we went out and swept the remains out of the ATU. Something else a lot of people don't think about is guy wire anchors. Has anybody ever seen a guy wire anchor fail, a concrete one, how they can shatter sometimes? Has anybody ever run into that yet in the field? I've seen one tower come down in the Bahamas because of it. What happens if you don't have your anchor lines tethered? As lightning travels down, remember concrete is about 50% moisture. If you throw 10,000 amps through something that conducts, what happens to it? It gets hot. It makes steam. Steam expands. Concrete explodes. Guy wire anchor goes, oh, nothing holding me here. Boom, gone. All right, so that's something else to remember. That little safety line that you see through the turnbuckles going to ground to the ground rod is not just there to keep the turnbuckles from unwinding. That's obviously one purpose, but it's definitely not the only purpose. All right, protect your anchors. Obviously, if you're running the steel bar anchors, that's less a situation. If it's arced, replace it. Chances are, if your Johnny balls look like that, they're not insulators anymore. That's a carbon trail. Now your insulator's a pretty good conductor. If you're standing out at the site and you're watching the lightning, the little mini lightning storm on the windy day as the guy wire insulators continually arc, that's what you're creating slowly but surely. There are products that can help that, bleeder resistors, the little chimney brush looking static dissipators. There are a lot of people that will argue that they don't work, but I've had sites that were originally down for an hour at a time during a windstorm because of discharge. Put sets of them on and go down to 30 seconds during a windstorm. I can't necessarily prove or disprove the theory. I can't tell you that every site that I've seen that's installed them has seen improvement. Okay, Cortana makes those, Lightning Masters out of Florida, ERI provides a brand of them. Not to give any brand plugs. Is Paul in here this morning? I don't see the hand waving. Okay, good, he slept in. He didn't hear the plug. Okay, so the big things, ball gaps, low inductance straps, ground rods. We prefer a minimum of 4 at the base of the tower if you can do it. Remember the spacing. Spacing is critical. Get them out there. Connect them with straps. Silver solder it. Static drain path. Now, if you're an FM, your antenna is your drain path. But then you got this tower or this antenna up there several hundred feet or 1,000 feet. You got this coax coming down. Please, please, please don't forget the ground kit on the coax. Otherwise, I'll give you an example. I mean, I run into a lot of really smart engineers. Most of them know what they're talking about as a rule. It's easy to overlook little things sometimes, or you inherit an existing site, and it's easy to assume that something was done because everything else has been done right. We had one, we were talking about it this morning. It was a little further south down in Missouri. Not going to mention any names or any companies, but it was a 600-foot tower, as I recall. 10 feet away from the building, had a copper strap raised to the base of the tower, going over, coming into the building, going over to the transmitter. They weren't on the transmitter ground stud. It was bolted to the transmitter, which is an issue with us. We give you an isolated ground for a reason. But that was the only real big problem. What we found was there was no ground rod. Lightning hit the tower, come flying down the tower because it's this massive structure, a good path to ground. except when it got to the bottom, there's no real ground. There's a 4-inch strap going into a really good ground, which unfortunately was the chassis of our transmitter. They were losing, on average, several power supplies every couple of months on a transmitter that does not have a history of power supply failures. I happened to be down in our Quincy office, and the service guy said, "Do you mind running over to Columbia?" And I said, or Springfield, sorry, I'm wrong. And they said, "Sure, no problem. I'm right in the neighborhood." And they said, "Cool, we didn't know Quincy was that close to southern Missouri." And I said, "Oh, you don't mean Springfield, Illinois." So anyway, I hopped down, picked up one of the Quincy guys. We went down to Springfield, met the group guy down there, and we inspected this. We put in a ground rod there. We ran a strap around the building to the AC entrance ground, fixed that because it was just basically a rod laying on the ground instead of being driven into the ground. Changed a few things in the transmitter building. In all total, we ran 15 feet of strap and removed 20 feet of strap and one conduit. And that was in April. They haven't had a failure since. Okay, that's the difference. It took us maybe an hour's worth of work. The big problem was driving a ground rod in that southern Missouri clay. But you can get stuff at the rental centers for that. Okay. High voltage concerns. If you're running an AM, remember you got modulation on there. Don't just calculate 50,000 watts and assume it's good enough, because at peak mod, you're up around 80,000 watts. Okay, look at your output power, look at your antenna impedance, that's all known values. Assume VSWR. You can calculate your ball gaps pretty close. Just as a nominal 133 plus J15 at sea level, here's an idea of the gaps you should see. And if you look at 55,000 watts, it's just under a quarter of an inch, not 2 inches. Okay? A lot of people get really surprised when I walk into a 5 kilowatt, for example. I go to set the ball gap in the transmitter. I pull 3 business cards out of my pocket, shove them in the ball gaps, tighten them up till they touch the business cards, and then pull them out. 3 business cards happens to be roughly 5/100ths of an inch. Depends on your business cards. If you got those wafer-thin see-through ones, use a few more. I'd recommend feeler gauges as a rule, but that's the point being that most people assume that a 5 kilowatt, the lightning balls should be about a quarter inch apart, when really that's a 50 kilowatt. Set them as close as you can set them. I use the hammer whack method on antennas. Take a 2x4, jam them together till it starts to arc while the transmitter's running, then pry them apart until it doesn't. It's simple, it's brute force, and it works. Okay, so your perfect transmitter building will not be the one where the RF comes in over here and the AC comes out over there. It will have everything bonded together, preferably with a shunt type MOV or a series type if it's in the budget. They cost more, but they work. And you'll have a common ground point established. If you have a perimeter ground, have it outside the building and only have the ground coming in at one point. We call it star grounding, some people call it tree grounding, some people call it single point grounding. The concept is the same. You have one entry point, everything branches off of that, you don't have a loop for current to go through. If the transmitter's hanging off there, totally isolated from ground, except for this one strap coming down, lightning comes down and goes, well, no point going there, I can't get anywhere. It'll keep going to the power line. Power companies spend a lot of money giving us a really good path to ground, let's use it. Okay. So the things you want to look at. A ground ring is good because it gives us a nice, and this is something else Gary and I were discussing. I'm taking Gary's name in vain an awful lot here. I apologize for that. But surface area is everything. The more space, the more physical conductive area we have to dissipate this strike to ground that isn't my transmitter or your transmitter, then the better off we are. Put ferrites on the coax lines. Okay, a ferrite is an awesome, awesome device. Do I have anything on ferrites in here? I'm not going to skip through it. I don't want to run too far on time. But a ferrite effectively is a common mode choke. If you have the ferrite around two conductors and put a current through one conductor only, like a lightning surge on a shield, it'll saturate the ferrite and increase the overall impedance, the collective impedance of the line. It will also attempt to induce an equal surge on the opposite conductor, on your center feed. Well, if I've got two conductors, one feed, one return, and one goes up like that, now I've got a pretty significant chance of blowing something up. If I take them both up, the potential difference between them doesn't change, and my transmitter doesn't know the difference. I wouldn't want to be the guy leaning on the transmitter at the time, but from an equipment point of view, we'll save the gear. Now, if I have a ground kit on there to tie the coax shield to ground, it becomes a non-issue. Now my chassis doesn't get hot either. That makes me very happy because I get to live longer. I've been doing this job 16 and a half years. Knock on wood, I haven't blown anything too terribly wrong. I got a couple of scars because I'm here to tell you 5 kilowatts will leave a mark. Okay, so what we're trying to do is get the lightning energy. If it has to come in the building at all, one thing we don't show here is we prefer a bulkhead ground where the coax enters the building, but if I have to run it in such a way that my common point is over here, put your bulkhead ground, your coax ground there. Shortest, lowest inductance path possible. If you're installing a surge box, put it near the AC, because the AC wiring to the surge box will be much higher inductance than the ground wiring to your reference ground. So if you don't have a choice, if I've got to put a surge box either here or here, put it close to the AC, so the AC wiring's the shortest possible. Put a breaker on it. Remember, it's fused disconnects with MOVs that you know are going to fail at some point. If you put a breaker on it, you can shut it down and work on it without taking the whole station off the air. Okay, I've run into places where the MOV was run right off the main disconnect. Relatively speaking, it's going to protect the site no matter what side of the circuit breaker it's on, as long as the circuit breaker's not open. If your circuit breaker's 50 amps and the fuses are 30 amps, that shouldn't be an issue. Improve your reference ground. Ground rods, remember the spacing again. Okay, I'm going to keep beating that drum because ground rods are no good if they're not there. They're even worse. We ran into a site in Memphis where they'd been having a lot of failures, and we were looking, we went out, we did 3 different site visits over a year and a half. Okay, some of the best engineers in our company, guys with a little bit of field service experience, the contract engineer on site was the top dog, the consultant was one of the smarter guys I know. 3 or 4 different times we were down there, didn't find anything until one day, out of exasperation, we're walking along and some guy looks at the pull pigs, looks at the ground wire coming down, reaches down and discovers that it ends 2 inches below surface. Totally corroded away. Okay, a ground is not a ground if it's not connected to ground. Okay, things we can do to improve layout. Whoops. We can add that surge box. Come on. Reroute the coax. Okay, so we can get a shorter ground strap. A longer coax is better anyway. The further it is from the ground connection to the transmitter, the more impedance I got. Okay, the transmitter looks like a worse load. Put a ferrite between the ground and the transmitter. Let's see if I've got that coming up. There it is. Okay, surge protector by all means. We prefer 4-inch strap if at all possible. I mean, understanding that there is economics of scale here. If you're in a low risk area with a 1 kilowatt, 2-inch strap is probably going to be plenty fine. Big cable would be the next choice. All right, we've all told this story, and Rich was telling me he ran into one not terribly long ago. Zip cord connected to the ground stud wrapped around a cold water pipe is not a ground. Even if you put a pipe clamp on it, it's still not a ground. Okay, I was mentioning that I'd run into one on a little 250-watt rig in Indianapolis several years ago, it'll be 15 years ago now, and that was the ground connection for the transmitter, and they kept complaining that it was blowing PAs. And then we got talking, and they said, well, yeah, then, I mean, we had to buy this because we couldn't keep tubes in the old transmitter. I think it was a BC1. I said, whoa, you couldn't keep tubes in a BC1? Why? Well, they kept failing. It kept blowing the drivers, it kept blowing the tubes, it kept blowing the blockers, and I was like, okay, something's seriously wrong here. When you can blow up a transmitter like that, then you're not doing it. And then we saw the ground and say, okay, I understand a little more now. 2-inch ground strap out to a ground rod, boom, problem solved. Okay? Choke locations, if feasible. I emphasize if feasible because up till a couple of years ago, a choke to go over a 3 1/8-inch line was pretty expensive. The only one we could find was about $600. Again, economy of scale. If I'm not in Florida, I'm not going to spend that for a piece of ferrite. Now we can get bigger ones. They are less expensive. Put it on the coax near the transmitter. When we ship a transmitter, you'll find that there's ferrites included with the ancillary kit. We also provide toroid kits separately. If you don't have one of our gears, we'd be happy to sell you the toroid kit. You know, we're pretty flexible about that stuff. Okay, so on the coax near the transmitter, near the input to the ATU, yeah, it doesn't hurt. Definitely on audio cables. Okay, your STL antenna can get nailed and feed a spike right straight through your audio line into your transmitter. A lot of people don't think about that because it's only little stuff. AC to the transmitter, all phases and ground. Remember the ferrite's common mode protection. It needs a feed and a return. Okay, if you just put it on the individual connectors, which with some balanced switching power supplies is actually a preferred mode, what you've created is a series choke. Okay, it's not a bad thing, it's an impedance, but it won't give you the benefit that you would get if you had all three phases and ground through there. Okay, remote control, another thing, typically, or frequently anyway, connected to an STL, which is connected, by golly, to an antenna, which is something that lightning likes to hit. And definitely AC cables to external equipment. Again, when we ship a box, there'll be 4 3/4-inch toroids in there that'll take a power cord and wrap it through once, twice. Okay, so there's a lot of things you can do. Okay, looking at electromagnetic susceptibility, as this lightning zips along that path and radiates all this ionized air, things nearby are going to start arcing and sparking. So ground chassis of equipment. Okay? If you've got stuff mounted in a rack, ground everything to a ground bus going down the rack. Most racks give you the option of a bus bar for ground. Just copper bar running down the side. Then ground the rack to your common point. Hey, it's little things that are easy to forget when you're under pressure to get something in and on the air. Okay? Circulating currents. This is, again, if you can get an antenna, if you can get AM into your FM transmitter, somewhere you've got a ground loop or a radiated power problem. And if that happens, then a lightning strike can make that same trip. All right, something to remember. So put up a Faraday shield. It's surprisingly cheap. If your ATU and your transmitter building is within the ground radius of your AM transmitter, run the radials over the roof of the building. Put the building below ground, effectively. It's easy to do. It solves an awful lot of problems, and it doesn't cost hardly anything at install time. Okay, we're worried about anything that isn't RF going to the antenna. Whether it's feedback, whether it's lightning, we don't care. There's an example of a Faraday cage. It's pretty crudely drawn. I'm not really an artist. That's probably a good thing. But that's all it is. Just run the radials over the roof. We've had guys put copper mesh on the roof and then tack it down at all four corners and once in the middle of the building. Okay, copper mesh is not cheap. That's a pretty expensive way of doing it. But an extra, you know, 20 feet on the radials as you go up and go down, that doesn't add a lot to the cost of the ground plane. Okay, if you bury your coax, bury it underneath the radials. Because the radials, although they're technically a counterpoise and not technically part of your lightning ground, will handle the bulk of the current on a near lightning strike, depending on your ground system. If your coax is underneath that, then it's not picking up all that energy and trying to radiate it back into your transmitter. Okay, highest voltage in your solid state transmitter, they will always be at the transmitter output. Always. Doesn't matter whose you have. In a tube rig, it can vary. Depends on the impedance of the plate circuitry, and I'm definitely not the guy to talk about those impedances. Okay? In the transmitter system, it depends. As you go from 50 ohms at the output of the transmitter to whatever the base impedance of the tower is, you can calculate the highest point pretty carefully. Once you know the impedances, you know where the biggest voltages are. Okay? Series chokes, DC blockers, Angles when you can put them in. Remembering, theoretically, lightning doesn't like to go around corners, but remembering there's a low frequency component that doesn't really care if there's a corner there or not. Okay, there are a lot of standard sort of rules of thumb in the industry. Most of them are very accurate. They're there for a reason. People have discovered, hey, this works. You know, you got that feed line, you put that one turn in there, it makes a difference. Get rid of the voltage gradients. Now remember I said lightning doesn't like to go around sharp corners. Well, the funny thing is, neither does RF. And RF will tend to jump off those sharp corners. Or you can create corona. And corona can disintegrate metal fairly quickly over a period of time, not to mention all the stuff that ARCs do. Okay, develop the voltage across insulators. We at Coast Guard put in a beacon unit, and they put the beacon tuning unit was inside a fiberglass building. They drilled a 2-inch hole in the side of the fiberglass building and ran the feed line out to the base of the tower. Okay, anybody with AM experience, it's done exactly the same as an AM feed. The downside is there's no ball gap there. When it rained, the fiberglass got wet. They burned down the fiberglass building and the ATU all at the same time. You know, for the want of a couple of $100 ceramic bowl insulator for the feed through, they ended up spending over $50,000 building an equipment, not to mention off-air time for a pretty important telegraph station. Okay, so definitely insulating bowl. Make sure you have a grounded ring on the outside. You need to create that voltage gradient. Otherwise, lightning's going to find its own path. You make sure you tell it where you want it to go. You will not stop every lightning strike. If you get one that's going to blow the ball gaps off your tower, somewhere something's going to fail. Nothing you can do about it. But you can really have an effect on how much it's going to cost and where that lightning's going to go. And like I say, the bulk of the sites I see, the difference is usually only 10 or 20 feet of strap and a ground rod. In some cases, it's actually removing. I walked into one site, we removed over 100 feet of strap, didn't add a single thing, and solved all the problems they had, because their problem were all circulating currents. They had ground loops everywhere. So start at the antenna, walk back to the transmitter, look at the strap, look at the coax, look at the connections between them, how close they are, look at where the lightning could get from over here to over there. Try to find a path to ground that is not through your equipment. Piece of cake. Easy stuff. Okay, it is easy after you've done it a while. There are several good reference on this. Two that I used, or that we used originally for this. Polyphaser, which is currently owned by LEA, got one called the Grounds for Lightning and EMP Protection that at one point we used to send with every AM transmitter we shipped. We believed that book was that well written. We have two on our website, recommendations for transmitter site preparation and one on grounding and lightning protection. Okay, both available on the resources tab of our website. We're more than happy to give you all the information you can. We don't care whether you got our box or not. We'll help you out any way we can. All right, any questions? I ran that one pretty close to the edge on time. I see a hand going up. Yes, Bob. Gary's bringing, or Tom's bringing you, Mike.
You've said a lot about lightning protection, but you've said virtually nothing about lightning protection on a mountain in California. It was about 10, 12,000 feet, 10,000 mm-hmm. probably. We put an FM transmitter in there. Fortunately, we were at a site where we were on the TV property. So about all I could do was run a ground strap over to their 4-inch ground strap and hope for the best. Now, I did take a walk around to some of the other antennas that were up there, which were basically microwave, two-way, and so forth. And I noted that they had this salt pit or whatever alongside of it. So your words of wisdom, sir.
Well, what they've done in that case, because of course on a mountain that high up, getting to the water table is a little bit of a challenge. And what they'll typically do is take, they'll, as you say, dig a pit. It's usually filled with salt and calcium carbonate or some conductive material. They create an artificial ground and then basically layer as much copper over the ground as they can to create their own ground plane. So, yeah, in that case, that's about the best you can do. I mean, drilling a several hundred foot well is probably not an option. So, absolutely, yeah, in that case, and I've used chem rods on occasion. If you're in an area where the soil conductivity is very low, they're a good answer. What a lot of TV stations used to do, and I suspect some still do, is that they'll dig this pit, they'll fill it with the conductive backfill, and they'll actually put a water feed into it, like just dripping water into it to keep it moist. And they'll establish an artificial ground, if you will, that way. So ultimately, as I said, the goal is to keep the potential difference between ground and your conductive equipment the same. So yeah, absolutely. In that case, you did the best you could with what you had to work with.
Two things. The grounds for lightning and EMP protection is out of print.
That figures.
But if you can get a copy of it, it's worth it. Their current book is called Grounding and Lightning Protection for Communication Sites, and it leaves some of the theory and some good images that you can help to understand it out of it. Second thing is dealing with an AM. There's an assumption that I've run into a couple times that the radials are sufficient to take lightning to ground. And there are two that I've worked on recently that added a lot of rods to them. But that particular assumption is out there that the radials are sufficient.
That's very true, and that's one of the things I mentioned just a little bit ago, that the radials are the counterpoise for the RF return current. They're not the ground path for the lightning current, and they can't really be expected to be one. I mean, if you look at your radials as a counterpoise, and I mean, everybody, I assume, has seen pictures of the elevated counterpoise. I've got pictures of me holding a fluorescent light bulb standing under one, and I'll tell you what, I was lit that day, but... Anyway, yeah, absolutely, the radials cannot be considered part of the lightning protection ground. That's not their purpose or their function. They can help by dissipating some current, but that's just a side benefit. It's not the primary purpose. Rich, you were waving your hand there.
Yeah, you bet. I'm totally with you on establishing the ground plane on one wall of the building for the power, the coax. But as you know, the Motorola spec has them bringing ground conductors in at every corner of the building for their token ring. And I've seen sites where it just burns connectors right off inside, because when the lightning comes in, it's got all kinds of pathways to create trouble.
Yeah, I've run into that situation, and in an area or in a situation where I can't bring only a single run in, where I've got the internal bus going around the perimeter inside the building and entries at every corner and usually at the middle of each wall, what I'll do in that point is make sure that all my equipment only connects to one point on that inside ring. So I'll establish a bulkhead on the wall, run a strap down to that ring, and everything I got connects to the bulkhead. All right, it's definitely not the preferred system, but sometimes you got to make the best with what you got to work with. Back in the corner there, I guess not technically a corner, but
no, we don't like corners, because lightning doesn't want to go around corners. My only comment is when you're doing grounding systems and bringing in a ground to establish a master ground bar or a station ground, we recommend the AT&T theory of grounding, which is something you can also look at on the internet. But we always recommend two parallel paths to that, not just a single conductor. The paths are close together, but they're not. They're actually two grounding conductors coming in. So in the case long term, one fails, you don't lose your grounding system.
They're connected at or near the same point on each end?
They're connected at near the same point on each end.
Then I don't have an issue with it. It increases surface area and improves conductivity. I'd be fine with that. Anybody else? Oh, way up front. Mark, giving Tom a workout today.
Absolutely. Hey, I had a couple questions. One, I've seen tower sites that run a strap from the top of their tower all the way down to the bottom to try to improve the efficiency of getting the lightning strike to the bottom. I didn't hear you say anything about that. And second, I've got a site where everything is in conduit. Do you actually put the ferrites around the outside of the conduit for the AC?
All right, to hit the first one first, that's typically done on TV and FM towers, and why it is a lot of times some of them used to install lightning rods and run a strap down or an insulated conductor. I kind of have an issue with anything that is designed to make sure the lightning hits the tower. The strap, though, what you're talking about there, what'll happen, and I've run into this overseas a lot, is that if the tower junction members aren't brazed together, or if you are worried about them breaking during flexing in wind, then a strap from top to bottom ensures a continuous path from the top of the tower down to the ground. I don't really worry about it much one way or the other. I think Bob Surrett had to go home, but that'd be something that the FM antenna guys might have more of an issue with than those of us protecting stuff on the ground. As far as the other, again, the conduit, while providing a little bit of a shield, actually acts as a bit of a ferrite itself because it's a conductive material with a feed and a return through it. Putting a ferrite around it sure can't hurt. I don't find it necessary to break the conduit so the ferrite's just around the material itself. So yeah, I've run into that and I've done it, and I don't have an issue with it at all.
Okay, Jeff, we're going to have to move on. Thank you very much.